On the heels of the Biden administration allocating $1 billion to clean up the Great Lakes region, we look at this freshwater system with a series of Wisconsin perspectives on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Bad River Tribe describes its conservation area like this: almost 500 miles of rivers and streams, over 30,000 acres of wetlands, 38 miles of Lake Superior shoreline, and the Kagagan Sloughs, where wild rice grows on sacred waters. What differences do you see in how First Nations think about or treat the Great Lakes? What do you want to learn about the system from Native Americans? 800-642-1234. Mike Wiggins Jr. is chairman and executive director of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, was formerly a conservation officer for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Mike, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here with you, Kate.
Good morning. How do you and your ancestors view the Great Lakes? What are those words like?
Well, you know, one of the things that I always enjoy about the Great Lakes, the Big Lake, starts and begins rooted in our migration story. After the retreat of the glaciers and upon searching and coming back from the eastern seaboard, you know, our stories talk about that place where food grows on water. And, you know, I think we've said that many times over the last, you know, decade. And it relates to the importance of wild rice in terms of the waters and the wild rice upon it defining our home. Mm-hmm. And so the Great Lakes, you know, definitely represent that in terms of, you know, the embodiment in spirit of where we're supposed to be as Anishinaabe. And one of the things that I think is really beautiful is, you know, there's an ancient memory, of course, that's goes back to the glaciers, along with that boomerang effect into a seventh generation vision, looking out into the future, analyzing the fact that as human beings on this planet, we're temporary, and the decisions we make are going to have effects on those future generations ahead of us. So there's this responsibility, this caretaking ethic that is really present when we're around our waterways, when we're drinking that water from, you know, nowadays our groundwater aquifers. But our elders have passed that seventh generation vision down, and they talk about how it's not just something that is for debate. Our need to take care of the ecosystems around us so that future generations have the blessings that we do, so to speak, is a responsibility that all of us carry. And I think that's one of the things that I see echoing across the water there.
I watched some gorgeous, gorgeous videos yesterday capturing the Kagagan Sloughs and the wild rice just growing in abundance. Can you tell us about how these sloughs and these bogs and these coastal lagoons, their significance for food and how they feed into Lake Superior?
Yeah, you know, so Madeline Island in the Apostle Islands, in our language, we call that Monongahela-Conegh, home of the flicker. But Madeline Island has been the ancestral center of our home. It's been the ancestral kind of spiritual and home-based center for Anishinaabe for thousands of years. There's old stories that I've heard from elders that talk about pathways, water pathways, and then foot pathways from Madeline Island to Cahokia and things like that way back in the past, and those trade routes. And it's always described, Madeline Island and the Kagagan wetlands area, the wild rice beds, are always described as an old-time kind of Jerusalem or Mecca of sorts. All the Anishinaabe from all across, you know, the lands would come through here, our people. And we still see that today in ceremony. We have, you know, many people from Northern Canada, over into the Western Minnesota prairie forest fringe, and even Turtle Mountain. When I think of Turtle Mountain, I think it's North Dakota. Mm-hmm. There's Ojibwe people coming across from the west, and then from Bowating near Mackinac Straits. We still see Ojibwe people, or as Anishinaabe, as we call ourselves too, coming through this area for ceremony and kind of rejuvenation. That's how important Madeline Island and the Coggin Sloughs realm has been to our people historically. When you look at 47% of the coastal wetlands, you look at all that wild rice, there's a little bit of a golden triangle that exists there between the Coggin Bad River wetland area, Chiamacung Bay, or otherwise known as Shawamigan Bay, here in front of Ashland, Wisconsin, so to speak. And then dovetailing into, so you got the Coggin Wetlands, Shawamigan Bay, dovetailing into the Apostle Islands, that trifecta forms the powerhouse habitat for the fishery of Lake Superior. When we get into some of the negotiations talking about things like commercial fishing and sustainability of resources, those state biologists and tribal biologists always talk about how this is the place that drives the overall health of the Lake Superior fishery. And so they can kind of predict how fishing will go up the North Shore of Minnesota, up towards Thunder Bay, all the way over east of the Keweenaw Peninsula, over on the other side of Houghton, Hancock, Michigan, by what's happening here on the northern waters off our reservation out in Lake Superior and the Apostles. What's happening here drives what happens over there for the fish. And that's how powerful this place is.
Wow.
And I think it dovetails back to why our ancestors chose this place as the center. It is a power place. You know, all places are sacred, but in terms of responsibilities, this place, the Bad River watershed, these aquifers, you know, the metallic mineral body that's conducting water up above us, and that coastal wetland Apostle Island kind of matrix is a power place for Lake Superior, helps keep her alive.
Chairman Mike Wiggins Jr., Executive Director of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, with us on the significance of the Great Lakes. You can join in 800-642-1234. Thank you so much for that geography and that placing of this really sacred and, you know, complex wetland system and how it impacts Lake Superior. I'm wondering, too, about your background with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission and what you learned as a conservation officer and in interacting with people on that job.
Yeah, well, as a glyphic conservation officer, you know, one of my duties was to basically monitor and protect resources, and those are shared resources between the tribes up here in what's called ceded territory, where we have hunting, fishing, and gathering rights from our treaties. You know, we were charged with protecting those resources along with monitoring what was going on from non-tribal, you know, hunters and fishermen too. one of the things that came out of our treaty affirmation there was the court ruled that as tribes we had these rights, but that we needed to regulate ourselves, and if we weren't able to do that, we would basically default back to state jurisdiction. And the tribes responded by forming what we now know as GLIFWIC, the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and through that we have a VOIP model code that sets forth all the rules and regulations for hunting, fishing, gathering. There's a lot of MOUs with the Forest Service and things like that. But as a GLIFWIC conservation officer, I would patrol from Mille Lacs Lake over in Minnesota all the way over to like Bay Mills, Michigan, towards the Mackinac Straits. And
that would be a really wide area.
Yeah, it was a great year to find yourself like in the springtime at ice breakup over by Mille Lacs Lake, monitoring the fishing and the netting and spearing. And then in deep November to be up in Bay Mills working the deer season up there,
wow.
You know, monitoring tribal members. It was an incredible kind of journey across the landscape where political boundaries really dropped away and you just started seeing the land for what it was in terms of an old lens of food and water and resources for people, all people.
Chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, Mike Wiggins Jr. with us sharing knowledge about tribal resource waters and conservation of the Great Lakes. What is the greatest threat to Lake Superior and the hundreds of rivers and streams that flow into it? What concerns you about pollution on the Great Lakes? Did you grow up visiting the Great Lakes or living in the region? What can you share about how they've changed over the decades? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chairman Mike Wiggins Jr. here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing Great Lakes cleanup and restoration, conservation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline crosses over 280 rivers and streams that flow indirectly into the Great Lakes. That's from Earth Justice. In the State of the Tribes address this week, President Shannon Holsey, leader of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, said they are extremely concerned about inadequate environmental analysis of the Line 5 pipeline that crosses the Bad River watershed.
Both the plan and the environmental review did not factor the hazards this proposal creates for the surrounding communities, including the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, as well as the ecosystems of the surrounding rivers and the local drinking water supply.
What do you want to know about the Line 5 pipeline and the potential risks to the Great Lakes? 800-642-1234. Chairman of the Bad River Band, Mike Wiggins Jr., stays with us. Chairman, what did you make of those words from President Shannon Holsey?
Well, I definitely appreciated them. The draft EIS that came out from the state was, completely inadequate. And I think most people, of the 90% of testimony that was opposed to the Enbridge reroute, over and over, everybody called for a complete, redrafting and a reassessment that's got objectivity. I appreciated her words, and the threat to from Enbridge Line 5 is real. It's imminent, and both inside our reservation boundaries, within our waterways, and then from the reroute proposal, which is still in our waterways, and probably even more significantly in a sensitive area where our surface waters and our groundwater aquifers interact. And that's following USGS, water data.
So Line 5, 645-mile pipeline operated by Enbridge that is transporting crude oil, natural gas liquids from Superior, Wisconsin to Ontario. When you talk about the sensitive area, what are the risks of Line 5 to Lake Superior in particular?
Well, in our area, you gotta back out and think about the Great Lakes as the freshwater stronghold of America. And Lake Superior, sitting here with 10% of the world's fresh water, it can boggle the mind a little bit on how important and real that's going to be as we move forward through a lens of climate change, through a lens of war, through a lens of dwindling resources and population growth. It's imperative that we think about the future through a lens of water, not corporate profit. And so when you look at Line 5, it's well beyond its engineered life. It has a history of failing and pipe ruptures that essentially decimate those particular areas and then the downstream waterways and resources also. So in Bad River, where the line runs across our reservation, there are washouts occurring. A few years ago, we found an area that we refer to as Slope 18. It's in Denimy Creek. We found that area to have sloughed away, and we found the pipe just hanging in midair. We discovered that and brought that to the attention of Enbridge. Their response was, in retrospect, oh, yeah, we knew about that. Hmm. But at the same time, nothing was ever brought forward. The thing is, when you're conducting, millions of barrels of oil and crude from the tar sands like that, a rupture in our waterways and the Bad River, when we looked at some of the emergency response scenarios, there were spills similar to Kalamazoo, that when we looked at the lens of what would that mean, it was literally the black snake of tar and ooze rolling through our riverways, through the mouth of the Bad River and out in Lake Superior. Those things are real. And so having the reroute up in the hills above our reservation in the areas like Copper Falls State Park, where there's a lot of waterfall action, where there's a lot of mixing of our surface waters and our groundwater aquifers, meaning the drinking water that all of the region drinks, having an oil pipeline blast their way through there, because if you look at the draft EIS that the state put out, Enbridge wants to explode in bedrock at 139 places to try to seat their pipe in that area up there. You know, in that area where our drinking water and surface waters are interacting, you know, that it's one of the reasons why the USGS reports always refer to those high hills as the recharge for the Bad River watershed. It's just a illogical and foolish, feeble effort that just isn't justified by Canadian companies' profit margins. And, you know, I'll say this, that when you move across the line over into Mackinac Straits and the extremism that's proposed with tunneling under the Mackinac Straits, floating their way through that bedrock there and whatever aquifers may be therein, it's just an unbelievable kind of approach within the freshwater stronghold of America, you know, for what is essentially limited and financial gain to a private entity. I think the resources of our area, of our tribe, when I look through a lens of we want to be around another 1,000 years, when I look through that long lens, so do Wisconsinites, so do people from Michigan, so do Americans. This really kind of gets into, in my opinion, nation building and how do we want to move forward into the future together, the shared home around the Great Lakes. And we're not even talking about the fact that more and more people are going to want to move here, are going to kind of climate
migrate.
Climate refugees are going to be coming here for the water. It's going to be imperative that, you know, we take a deep breath and protect what we have right now to send that stuff into the future.
Mike Wiggins Jr. with us, Chairman, Executive Director of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Let's bring on a call. Chris is with us from Port Wing. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Good morning, and bonjour and miigwech to Chairman Mike for doing such a great job of putting wisdom out there for us to glean from. I just want to add on the Line 5 issue that as a long-term white resident of the Lake Superior watershed, the DNR's process is severely flawed because we're taking some of the worst carbon-loading oil, investing in infrastructure that's amortized over decades that is going to be a stranded asset when we stop using it because it's a failed system, and we're wasting money that we should be investing in ways to reduce our climate impacts. And I want to just say we need a better process overall that looks at the whole picture, and I'm sure Chairman Wiggins reflected that in his comments. I wanted to ask the chairman what he sees the Bad River's approach to working to reduce the dramatic effects of climate change, because I know the band has done some tremendous things recently, and I'd like him to talk about what his vision for working to reduce climate change is.
Chris, thank you. Chairman Wiggins.
Well, you know, thank you for that question. I mean, we're moving and we're looking at a strategic plan that incorporates energy independence. You know, most recently I'll go back to 2016. We had a 1-in-1,000-year flood, ironically, in one of the flood scenarios that really blew open and exposed, you know, the dangerous threat of the Line 5 pipe. But it blew out every, you know, culvert, roadway, and turned our reservation home into an island, so to speak. It was such a powerful flood and storm. We had our power knocked out for days, and so we're responding by building solar microgrids that put us on autonomous independent energy. We're targeting right now key places within our government, like wastewater and water treatment facilities, our health and wellness center, which is our clinic and pharmacy, things like that. We're putting them on autonomous energy so that no matter what in the future, those places will be independent. But we're taking a longer look across our residential communities and other tribal resources to make sure that you know, we're utilizing a combination of renewables to make sure we're taken care of and getting ourselves off of fossil fuels as much as possible into the future. The other thing that, you know, we're doing is we're protecting our mineral body. You know, the Pinoki Mountains hold, 20 billion tons of metallic mineral that's conducting groundwater up to the surface, rushing on down through our watershed and out in the Big Lake. When you think about climate change, you know, Lake Superior is the fastest warming of all the Great Lakes. There's studies that show by 2060, Lake Superior, Lake Michigan won't even be receiving ice cover, full ice cover, or ice cover in general. Those are alarming. Yeah, those are alarming scenarios. And so, you know, we're trying to do our best in real time to put a little bundle of preservation together to send into the future with this place.
Chairman Wiggins, thank you for joining us. Mike Wiggins, Jr., Chairman and Executive Director of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the future of the Great Lakes as the Biden administration allocated $1 billion in cleanup and restoration. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has what they call a greater than great graphic. It says almost 30 million people earning $1.3 trillion, enjoying 6 quadrillion gallons of water. So pause the numbers. What do you want to know about the Great Lakes that you never asked? 800-642-1234. Ashley Elgin is a research ecologist with NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, studying the bottom area of the lakes, which have been particularly altered by invasive mussels. Ashley, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yes, hello, Kate. I'm glad to be with you this morning.
Good morning. So you and your colleagues at more than a dozen universities and agencies are collecting this data from the Great Lakes as they've been covered in ice, as they are in the winter. What are you hoping to learn?
Yes, well, several of my colleagues and I, we've embarked on something called the Winter Grab. And it is a highly coordinated effort to visit sites all over the Great Lakes Basin so that we can start filling in gaps and understand, you know, that many things about what we don't know for the Great Lakes.
So what does this winter grab entail? How do you orchestrate it?
Well, it's been a long time in the planning. And what it generally is that there are 25 stations that we've identified across the Great Lakes Basin, many colleagues that represent both Canadian and U.S. federal and academic institutions are going out. We're using agreed upon and standard methods to visit these stations. And getting down to it, we had to use very creative methods to get to our stations. Some people are using snowmobiles. Some people are hiking out onto the ice. My colleagues, we used an airboat to get out to our station. And once we reach the station, we are cutting holes in the ice so that we can get measure the light levels above and below the ice in the water, measuring temperature, oxygen levels in the water. We also collected water samples so we can analyze nutrients and identify the algae that are there, zooplankton, and also microbes that are in the water and thriving this time of year.
Well, it sounds like it's like a physical or a wellness check at the doctor in a way. You know, do you feel like you don't have adequate data, or why do you need to do this type of it sounds almost like basic research on in the coldest months?
That's exactly it. You know, I thought of it myself as this is a chance to take the pulse of the Great Lakes at all times of the year, including in the winter. And in general, winter has been understudied. It's for a few reasons. One, it's very difficult to get out and do work in the winter. It's logistically very challenging. As I mentioned, you have to get creative of how you're going to safely reach your sites. But then also, there is There's kind of this misconception that went on for a while that winter was a time of very low activity and almost dormancy in the water. But we have a much better idea now that that's not the case, and that there's a lot more happening during winter than we appreciated before.
I would imagine you would say, I beg to differ, as I study the bottom of lakes, there's a lot going on. Is that true?
Yeah, there is. There's always a lot happening down in the mud. That's, you know, I tell people I have a wonderful living studying the mud and everything that lives down there. Absolutely.
So, you know, collecting these samples, you've got Canadian and federal and academic institutions all collaborating, all pooling this data. Once you get that, then what happens? How do you use it? How does it inform your research?
Yes, and you know, thinking about what's so important about this approach that we had is by using standard methods, and some of the samples are even being sent, so they're being the water collected is being analyzed by the same lab. Hmm. When you have that consistency, it just allows for very strong and solid comparisons across all these regions. It also is encouraging us and helping to establish protocols that we can use going forward so that we'll have solid opportunity to analyze the differences among the sites in this 1 year, and also to compare this to future changes. And, you know, the most immediate thing we want to look at is, you know, think of how large the Great Lakes region is, and the conditions that are found up in Lake Superior right now are very different than what's being found in Lake Erie. And so we need to better understand under different light conditions, different levels of you know, different ice thickness, if the ice has been moving around or if it's been set up in that area for a while, we're going to have a chance to have a lot of variation in that ice factor across the Great Lakes region. And then that gives us an opportunity to see, under these conditions, what does the community look like under the ice?
Wow, so many variables to take into consideration. Yes. Ashley Elgin with us, research ecologist with the NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, explaining her piece of knowledge and research underway on the Great Lakes. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us from Madison. Hi, Lisa. What is on your mind?
Yeah, well, I hope I'm not diverting the discussion here too drastically, but I recall reading a year or so ago about some efforts on the part of non-native agencies to manipulate the fish populations in one or more of the Great Lakes, and it was rather a drastic manipulation that they were able to accomplish, substituting one trout subspecies for another, mostly for the benefit of sport fishing. And I'm just wondering, I assume that stopped. No one's doing that anymore. I'm wondering if they were able to restore the original species balance in the Great Lakes that were affected by this.
Lisa, thank you for that question. Ashley, any insight there?
Well, fisheries is a bit out of the usual area I study, but I can speak to that at the level of having coordinated and involved stocking programs for many fish species across the Great Lakes. That has been a common aspect of Great Lakes fishery management for decades. And we do have several non-native fish that are a regular part of the Great Lakes ecosystem, you know, the salmon species, and as a primary example. And they're only present because of active stocking in the Great Lakes. And lake trout is another species that's actively stocked. So it's, you know, we have absolutely non-native species that are actively managed and stocked in the Great Lakes, but they are seen as having a benefit for recreational fishing.
So I would imagine it's a really tricky balance to sustain the ecosystem as it exists, but also make way for recreational purposes, which are also, you know, all of these competing interests you really have to balance.
Mm-hmm. And I think we all have this the strong sense of identity and connection to living in the Great Lakes region. I know I grew up in the UP, and I very strongly associate with the Great Lakes, and I always have. And, you know, think about changing conditions of the Great Lakes over our lifetime. We've observed it in climate, maybe changes in how the winters are, how the ice cover has been. You know, all of that influences how we interact with the lakes through the seasons. And, it's very important because that's a strong part of our identity.
Tina in Green Bay called in, couldn't stay with us. And Tina and their family did this circle tour of the Great Lakes in 2018. And then before the trip, the family together read The Death and Life of the Great Lakes by Dan Egan. And Tina just said, highly recommend the book and also taking that circle tour to really get a sense of the expansiveness of the Great Lakes. Ashley, what do you think of that?
Well, first of all, I commend her on her commitment to understand, you know, reading that book as a family activity, going on this circle tour, because what an amazing way to fully understand the what's happening of the stressors to the Great Lakes, but then also getting to the same time do the circle tour, take in the beauty of the Great Lakes. So I what a wonderful experience. She's a lucky family.
You know, as you take in all of this data and you want to make sure that you're able to do it in a standardized way, which you figured that out with all of these partners, but, you know, really what we need to know are historical trends and the trends that we can make out to understand how our climate is changing and how climate change is going to be affecting us in the next generation and for generations to come. Is that really helpful in what you're doing now to be able to give us those historical trend lines?
Yes, there are several aspects here that we've measured this year, in this last week, what we're all able to measure. There are some historical values that we can touch back to. And in that way, we're making sure we have a more complete record going forward, because we identify there are many gaps in the data record going back. And now we need to say, well, let's get a hold on that. Let's have better baseline data that represents where we're at now, compare it to the past, and then have better data going forward.
When you look at the impacts of climate change, do you see it? When you look at that data, do you see the change?
It's most clearly evident in the change of ice cover.
Okay.
The trend in ice cover has declined over the last several decades. And that's one, I would say, if we were to point to one thing, that's what we understand. But, you know, and ice cover is always a large area of interest of what's happening year to year in the Great Lakes. And I'm glad that we're bringing more to the conversation of what's happening then under the ice. How is that impacting the communities under the ice? And so it's not just about ice cover, but it's the full picture.
And we're going to look more fully what's under the ice and the ecosystem there with research. Benthic ecologist with NOAA, Ashley Elgin, studies the bottom of lakes and invasive aquatic species. Are you an ice fisher? What would you like to know about what happens when the lakes are frozen over? Have you seen the impact of zebra mussels, of round gobies, of lamprey in the Great Lakes? What have you noticed? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ashley Elgin here on the Ideas Network. It is the Great Lakes in Focus on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden last week announcing a $1 billion investment in Great Lakes Basin cleanup and restoration.
Dredging polluted sediment, restoring wetlands and habitats, making the water safer for swimming, fishing, drinking, providing habitats for wildlife and wildfowl. And the study found that every dollar we spend cleaning up the Great Lakes generates between $3 and $4 in economic benefit. That's a fact.
Are you worried that we're damaging the Great Lakes beyond repair? What predictions or remedies have not come fast enough? 800-642-1234. NOAA research ecologist Ashley Elgin stays with us. Let's bring on another caller. Mark is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mark. What are your thoughts on the Great Lakes?
Hi, I'm the president of the Wisconsin Animal Protection Society. And so, of course, we favor appreciating wildlife, fish, without having to have recreational opportunities that would include fishing, such as ice fishing, that the lakes can be enjoyed by kayaking, swimming, canoeing, all those things, and that people should think in terms of those kinds of recreational and a disappreciation of nature instead of fishing, killing fish.
Mark, appreciate those insights. And Ashley, you have to take all of those perspectives into account as you look holistically at the Great Lakes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, we all interact with the Great Lakes in many different ways. And we, you know, some people make their living off the Great Lakes. Some of us visit it briefly. Some of us live on them. And so we do have to balance the many needs and desires that people have in interacting with this resource.
You have expertise in invasive species and, you know, the zebra mussel, something that comes to mind. What effect have invasive species had on the Great Lakes?
Well, it's, I think for every invasive species we have, I could give you many reasons and or many ways that they've had effects. I'll focus, since you mentioned the zebra mussel and also the closely related quagga mussel, and they have had, they're essentially ecosystem engineers. They have altered the light environment, the nutrients, the habitat, and the Great Lakes food web, and the food web of any lakes where they're introduced. So very, very far-reaching impacts just from those two mussel species alone, which are acknowledged as some of the most impactful invaders in the Great Lakes.
How do they do that? Because to be ecosystem engineers, I mean, that takes a massive amount of either invasive potential or it just means that they're really good at altering the underwater environment.
Yes, they are small but mighty filtering machines. And I think that's the essence of how they're able to have such a strong impact, because the water is going to, when the water filters through the mussels, they pull out the algae. So thinking of algae as the base of the food web, it reduces the amount of food and energy that's available for higher levels, like ultimately to fish.
So when you can see more clearly down mm-hmm. toward the bottom of a lake, what does that do to, you know, everything in between as the water becomes more clear?
A lot of cascading effects here. You know, one thing that's interesting is when you have greater light penetration, deeper light penetration into the water, there's algae living on the bottom that can, they'll do better because they have more light reaching them on the bottom. So that's how we get something called cladophora, which is a nuisance algae. It grows and then it sloughs off in these large stinky mats that wash up on the shore. So that's one way that higher light is, you know, causes an issue for us. But in having more light, there are certain fish predators and even zooplankton predators that they're able to better find their prey when it's bright in the water. Mm-hmm. And so you have other species that are eaten more because their predators can see them. So it's there's just many ways that when you change the light, you change a lot of interactions in the food web.
Such a ripple effect in the food mm-hmm. web. You know, Lake Superior being so deep, how do you get down there in order to study the environment?
We largely rely on deployed equipment because it's just too deep for divers to go down.
Mm-hmm.
Our primary piece of equipment we use is something called a ponar grab, and it's a large metal claw that we deploy down using a winch, and it's on a wire. It goes down, it grabs up a huge clump of sediment. We pull that up onto the boat and we sieve through that. And that's how we get the bottom grabs and find the organisms, so we know what's living on the bottom.
Then I would.
And we're also using video now as well. I'll add that.
I was
really
going to ask, is there
mm-hmm.
a camera that's going down there so you kind of know what?
Yes, there is.
Yeah, mm-hmm. what the grabber is getting at or going toward. So when you pull that sediment up, is it different what you find each time when you log what is coming up?
Yeah, we make notes of what the sediment texture is like, the composition of the sediment, that it varies from one lake to the next. It varies by depth, and it depends what region, if you're in a bay of a lake versus out in open water. And it can go from being coarse sand to being just goo. Like, we've been in the middle of Lake Michigan, and we've pulled up this creamy black goo that is the sediment on the bottom. And I thought we could sell this to spas in Chicago. This is really fine stuff.
Don't give them any ideas, yeah, right. Please. But, you know, why is there such variation in what is at the bottom of these lakes? What accounts for that variation?
A lot of it is what's being deposited in those areas, you know, what kind of what particles are being deposited down. So if you have due to water movement, waves, just sedimentation throughout the lake, it's greatly influenced by the temperature that those animals experience at the bottom. And then the very big one is the nutrients that are coming in. So more near shore environments, you have nutrients coming off the landscape, and that creates more productivity closer to the near shore.
Are you talking about the runoff? Is that?
Yep. Mm. Yeah, that would be. Yeah, runoff is one way. Yeah, to get nutrients. You can have a natural source of nutrients coming in, but we do have human amplified runoff that increases nutrients.
Let's go to Becky in Houstisford. Becky, hi.
Hello there, and thank you so much for taking my call. Thank you for exploring this subject. The Great Lakes are so vital, and yet we seem to take them for granted too often. I wanted to know, when she referred to samples that they were referring, what they're doing currently with what they had in the past, does she have any information on how far back the records go? Is it a matter of decades or centuries? How far deep do they go into the substrata of the mud or the soil at the bottom? And do they see evidence of changes in the other gastropod levels, the mussels and clams and non-invasive species? Have their numbers declined in dramatic ways with the advent of the zebra and quagga mussels? Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Becky. Great questions. Multiple there, Ashley. Go ahead.
Becky, I think we need another half hour to cover all these questions. You hit on a lot of the main points. So talking specifically about how what kind of samples we have for the benthic environment from bottom grab samples, the earliest we have in Lake Michigan is due to the 1960s, the benthic community has been studied. We know from that you know the community that was in the bottom now is very different from what it was like in the 1960s. And she asked about other gastropods or bivalves that are present. There's small native spherid clams, also called fingernail clams. They have declined since the zebra and quagga mussels have arrived. And mostly out in deep waters in the Great Lakes, you don't have many of the native large unionid mussels. But in nearshore areas and inland waters throughout the Great Lakes Basin, they're much more common, and they have declined as a result of the zebra and quagga mussels.
Ashley, thank you for joining us.
That time went fast. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
Ashley Elgin, research ecologist with the NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. Earlier, we talked with Bad River Tribe Chairman Mike Wiggins, Jr. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.